the top five firings that occurred under my watch while I was in WCW. So let's get it started and see who the top five firings were under my watch in WCW.
Top five. Your number five is Brian Pillman.
Ah, Brian Pillman. That's a weird one, though. I know technically, yes, he was fired, but it's a strange one because it was an understanding that Brian and I had. And I know there's all kinds of history and everybody's got a different opinion. But, you know, Brian was smart enough to realize that the deck was pretty well stacked at the top. Brian felt like he needed a change. He needed to refresh his character. He was really digging the you know, crazy Brian Pillman gimmick and taking it to an extreme. And it was fun as hell. Trust me, I enjoyed it. But I think Brian was looking for a way out. He wanted to come back, but he was looking for a way out so he could go expand his character and kind of continue building that whole crazy Brian Pillman character. So while technically it was a firing, both Brian and I talked throughout that period of time when he was in WWF at the time, and we talked about him coming back and when would be the best time. And it was an interesting situation, but Brian ultimately, you know, ended up doing what he wanted to do. I ended up focusing on what I needed to focus on. At the end of the day, yes, Brian Pillman was one of those controversial firings or terminations, but it was mutual. So I'm going to include it just because it was so controversial. But I certainly didn't enjoy firing. I didn't enjoy firing anybody. That's another really interesting misconception and narrative that I've heard throughout the years is I was just, you know, on this power trip and I love firing people. The truth is, I felt exactly the opposite. I hated firing people. There were a lot of people I should have fired. And I never did. Kicking myself in the ass to this day. Most of them weren't talent, really. They were people that were in the office. But nevertheless, I get credit and criticism for letting Brian Pillman go. But you know what? In reality, if I were put into the same situation under the same circumstances and conditions, I would have made the same decision today. I don't regret it.
How difficult, or if there was any difficulty, was it to work with a talent that the lines between reality and character is kind of blurred?
Yeah, that's a good question, because there are extremes. You know, on one end, the healthy end of that extreme, the professional and profitable end of that extreme, are characters who are extensions of their characters in real, or their characters are extensions of their real personality, so that line is almost always, you know, murky at best, and sometimes it's hard to find it. And I enjoy that. I enjoy working with characters who have strong characters, a great sense of who they are, and push the envelope. And sometimes, you know, when talent wants to push the envelope, they're creative people by nature, they're performers by nature, and they're constantly striving to perfect and in some ways develop new aspects of their character. And sometimes what they see in their head, what talent sometimes see in their head as a good idea, may not make sense from a business perspective. So it could be difficult. And on the other end of that extreme, you've got people who actually believe they are their characters. That becomes a real issue, because the connection to reality becomes a problem. And we've seen far too many people who, while they're in the business, can't separate themselves from their character. And that can become an issue. And we've seen a lot of people who, long after they get out of the wrestling industry, still have a difficult time separating who they really are from the character that they perceive the audience wants to see. And that can sometimes be sad. But yeah, it's a challenge, but it's, you know, I think that's true, Super Dave, in all forms of entertainment, right? Directors for movies and television have to deal with that issue. I'm sure if you're in a rock band, you know, for any length of time, you've got chemistry issues and personality issues and conflicts. And I just think creative people by nature are constantly pushing the envelope if they're successful. And the harder you push and the farther that envelope expands, so you have to push even further, it does create conflict. But I think it just goes with performers of all kinds.
Is it difficult to find that balance of you love the character they're portraying on television and you're pushing them and you're encouraging them, but then behind the scenes, is it difficult to like, on one hand, you're patting them on the back, and on the other, you're like, okay, wait, the cameras are off. I'm talking to you about business, or I'm talking to you about direction. Let's focus here.
Yeah, it could be in some situations. I never really had that issue. I didn't. Again, because I've always enjoyed people who were really invested in their characters. But I've never really had a situation backstage where I had to like verbally shake somebody out of their dream and wake them up to the fact that we're not really on TV right now. This is, you know, two people talking. This is business. This isn't performance. It happened, but it was never really an issue for me.
All right, let's go to number four, Sean Waltman.
That's an interesting one, right? Because I always liked Sean Waltman. You know, I from the first few times that I saw him in the ring, you know, 1-2-3 Kid and WWF. And, you know, he's from Minneapolis. Sean was from North Minneapolis. He actually didn't live. He lived like four blocks from me for a while when we were both living over in North Minneapolis. And I always liked him. I respected what he did. He was able to deliver. You know, that was at a time when you didn't see a lot of guys who were not 225 pounds and up. It was before the cruiserweight division. So Sean immediately brought an athleticism and a presentation to the ring that very few other people at that time were doing. He could fly, he could bounce, he sold. Like, he was an amazing, amazing performer when it came to selling. So I always enjoyed him. And certainly when he came to WWE as Six, or whatever we called him at the time, Six Pac, was a spinoff, 1-2-3 Kid. Get it? Pretty smart, right? I can add.
Brilliant.
But, you know, I was really happy that he showed up in WWE, that he came to WWE, and I had the chance to bring him in. But the chemistry between him and Scott and Kevin was so good. I mean, Sean Waltman really brought a layer of, I don't know, I hate to keep using the same word too much, but authenticity. And vibe, just brought a vibe to the NWO that just enhanced the kind of cool factor that the NWO was embracing at that point in time. And I like Sean. I always got along with Sean. We never really had any problems backstage, at least that I can remember, nothing significant. Communication was always pretty easy with Sean. For the most part, you know, he really conducted himself as a pro. Of course, you know, there's a time he pulled Flair's trunks down on purpose and showed his ass. Not that that hadn't happened before, but actually I was under a fair amount of pressure from Turner Broadcasting at the time to kind of tone down some of that, some of those elements of what happened in the ring, because it was causing an issue with ad sales, and advertisers were noticing it and speaking out. But getting rid of Sean, that was an issue, and it really wasn't an issue between Sean and I, because Sean and I had worked out an agreement. In fact, we had sent, we had negotiated Sean's agreement. I think it was a renewal at that point in time, and or an extension. And we had negotiated money, time, you know, number of days in the contract, all the standard details had been negotiated over the course of a couple months, really. It took some time. By the time you start negotiating with talent and agents, and then the attorneys get involved, and then they write contracts, and they get drafted and redrafted and redrafted and redrafted. Attorneys love doing that shit, man. They just, because they get paid by the hour, most of them. But by the time we got it all done, we finally had the contract done, and I had signed it. We thought we had a done deal, and we, meaning WCW, myself particularly, sent it off and didn't hear anything back for a period of time. Could have been a week or 10 days, 2 weeks, whatever. And that didn't really bother me too much, because again, we were slow getting the contract to Sean. So it was, you know, at least half of our fault. But all of a sudden it started going beyond a week, week and a half, 2 weeks. And finally put some pressure on Sean's agent at the time. And lo and behold, they decided, yeah, we don't want to agree to what we've already agreed to. We want to reopen negotiations. And that was like, that for me was a red line. You know, when you shake hands with somebody, verbally agree with somebody, come to a meeting of the minds, as they say in contract law, I take this up pretty personally. You know, when I give somebody my word, I give them my word. If I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. Good or bad, whether I want to do it or not, after thinking about it, if I commit to it, I'm going to follow through and chalk it up as a learning experience. And when Sean's agent, manager, whatever he was, decided he wanted to take advantage of an opportunity to renegotiate a deal that we'd already been talking about for a long time, it's like, nah, can't do that. And in a way, it was, I don't want to say it was unfair to Sean because he was a participant, but he was relying on his manager, and his manager overplayed his hand, didn't think that I would make a move, and I did. Fired him immediately. And like within a week or less, next time I see Sean Waltman, he's in the ring for WWF, cutting a promo on me and a part of DX. And I really do think that DX became a much more viable version of the NWO, because that's all it was, folks. Hey, Dave Meltzer, if you're listening, because I heard some video of you the other day talking about how, you know, Vince McMahon ended up being the ultimate heel owner authority figure, you know, before I did. And you're wrong. Once again, you're wrong. I created that character, or I evolved as that character, is probably more appropriate, a full year before Vince McMahon decided to come out from behind the broadcast desk and take a role as that heel dominant manager or owner. But I think Sean Waltman added so much authenticity and credibility to DX for no other reason, setting aside his abilities in the ring and all. But Sean was a big part of that NWO vibe when it first took off. And to lose that was, I don't want to say it was a mistake, because again, faced with the same situation, particularly when you come to a meeting of the minds, you shake hands, you think you've got a deal, and then some, you know, manager decides he wants to take advantage to renegotiate. That's a fucking no-fly zone for me. That's just an absolute no-fly zone. I would probably do the same thing. In fact, I know I would, even if I saw that doing so would probably come back to put pressure on us creatively, as it obviously did with DX. But yeah, it was, you know, it's fun now. Sean and I are friends. We talk through it. You know, I see his side of the issue. He sees my side of the issue, and we both laugh about it now. Sean turned out just fine. He did just well, fine with his career, and as did I, ultimately. So it is what it is. But yeah, losing Sean, firing Sean, it was a tough one. It was a tough decision, but again, one that I would probably make today given the same circumstances.
Number three, Raven.
Ah, Raven. Raven. That wasn't hard. I didn't enjoy it. Let's be clear about that. I didn't enjoy it. I never enjoyed firing. Well, we'll talk about that. But for the most part, I never really felt good about firing anybody. But with Raven, I was just so tired of his antics. You know, Raven spent a lot of time burying the company and kind of talking to the dirt sheets and doing radio interviews and trying to advance whatever agenda he had by trying to put pressure on me and WCW from the outside. And that's, again, that's another no-fly zone. It's just really, it's just not the way to conduct business. And I just get tired of it. And when I offered, you know, at one point, there was a lot of that going on. And it was really unfortunate because in many respects, WCW was at the peak of its success. We're just selling out arenas, selling out, you know, Nitros, selling out just about everything we did, generating revenue on top of revenue and exceeding expectations, budgetary expectations set forth by Turner Broadcast. We're blowing those goals out of the water. And it's funny how you would think that when things are going bad, that's when people would be the most aggressive and dissatisfied, wanting, you know, something different for themselves or something better for themselves. the frustration level across the board when things are bad. You would think that's when people start stirring the shit. But ironically, it was when things were really going well financially. And I guess that's probably where some jealousy and envy and frustration comes in. Because if you're someone like Raven was, who was, you know, he was like in the upper third of the, you know, television roster on any given, you know, Nitro. Guys like that want more. And there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. I respect that. You shouldn't ever be complacent in anything that you do. So I never had an issue with somebody wanting more. But with guys like, and Raven wasn't the only one, there were others. But I remember, I think it was in Minneapolis. It might have been here where I'm at right now in Minneapolis. And I just got tired of hearing all the bullshit, you know, in interviews and reading dirt sheet nonsense. So I called everybody together and said, look, if you don't want to be here, I'll let you out of your deal. And it was more of a, for me, it was more of, okay, I'm gonna put people in check. They're either going to stand up and say it to my face, or they're going to know that I know that they're just chicken shits and spreading shit on the dirt sheets trying to advance their agenda. Raven was the only one that raised his hand and said, all right, I'll go. And I respected that. I had more respect for Raven at that point than I had had at any point up until that moment, because he was standing up for what he believed in. And it's hard to disrespect people that do that. I have a lot of respect for people that will look you in the eye and tell you how they feel, and given an option, take one that is better for them at that moment. And Raven believed that it was better for him to leave, probably was at that moment, at that time. And he left. I say, and again, Raven's another guy that, you know, we've had on the show previously and in an interview. And again, great relationship with Raven today. We both, you know, have the benefit of experience to look back upon things and kind of no longer react to that situation with emotion, just kind of looking at it for what it was. And I think Raven probably feels good about the decision he made. And frankly, so do I. It was just time.
Number two, Steve Austin.
Ah, that's a fun one. God, it was a fun one. Not fun terminating him. Again, never enjoyed terminating someone. But I was a little motivated. You know, I've told the story before. I won't spend a lot of time talking about it. We've all heard it. But, you know, Steve had injuries, and that's not why I let him go. I let him go because while he was out with an injury, living in Atlanta, my goal was to keep his character alive. I didn't want people to forget about Steve. So wanted to cut a promo with him, backstage promo with Tony Schiavone, and just to keep his character out there and keep some anticipation for his return. And I asked Tony to reach out to Steve to see, because he wasn't scheduled, to his credit. He wasn't scheduled, but he lived in Atlanta. And I thought, let's early in the day, so let's get a hold of Steve, have him come in. We're still paying him. Let's have him come in and sit down and we'll do a promo with him. Schiavone went out, made the phone call. And when Schiavone came back, he explained what happened. And evidently, I wasn't on the call. So, you know, could be some murkiness in my recall on this, but I believe what Tony told me is, look, I called him, his wife answered the phone, I explained to his wife that we wanted to bring Steve down to Center Stage, where we were producing WCW Saturday Night Live at the time, and cut a promo with him. And I guess the way I remember the conversation with Tony is, Steve's wife at the time said, hey Steve, they want you to come in and cut a promo. And Tony was able to hear Steve say, tell them sons of bitches to go to hell, or something along those lines. And Tony relayed it back to me. And I thought, yeah, that's not going to work for me, brother. And I made the decision to let him go. And I'm really glad I did. It was one of the best decisions I ever made. Steve Austin feels exactly the same way I do. It was one of the best decisions I ever made, and really he ever made. Was leaving WCW, because at the time, again, you know, Hogan had just come in. Steve had an idea of something he wanted to do with Hulk, but the time wasn't right. Steve was frustrated. And I'm sure the injuries frustrated him as well. He probably felt like he was losing ground because he wasn't able to work for a bit. But look, if I wouldn't have let Steve go, there would have never been a Stone Cold Steve Austin. It took a while for him to find that character. And I actually did Steve Austin's podcast with him several years ago. I happened to be in LA, and Steve and I had always stayed in touch. And he had reached out and said, "Hey, I'm doing a podcast. You know, would you want to come over?" He lived in over Marina Del Rey at that time, not far from my daughter, actually, only blocks away from where my daughter was staying. And I was visiting her. I was there on business. So I went over to do a podcast. We thought it was going to take an hour or two, and we ended up spending about 3 or 3.5 hours. And as soon as I left Steve's, he called me on my way back to my hotel and said, "Hey, you want to come back tomorrow and do another one?" You know. And I did, and we drank copious amounts of beer, like, whoa, and just had a great time. But in that, if you go back and find it, you know, I'm sure it's in Steve's archives. We talked about, you know, Steve's perspective then, Steve's perspective now, as well as mine. And Steve's words were something to the effect of, "Hell, Eric, if I were you, I would have fired me too." So it worked out for everybody, right? And for me personally, because keep in mind, when I fired Steve, he wasn't Stone Cold Steve Austin. He was Stunning Steve Austin. When Steve left, he went to ECW, where Paul Heyman, to his credit, let the talent try to find their own characters and do what worked for them. And it was during that period of time, as I recall Steve telling me, that Steve was able to kind of tap into what became the Stone Cold Steve Austin character. And then Steve left ECW and went to WWE as what? The Ringmaster. Well, that didn't work, but it did open the door for Steve to kind of recreate or bring that Stone Cold Steve Austin character that he had really developed in ECW and bring it to WWE, and the rest is history. Now, for me, I'm grateful that I fired Steve, because as a result of all of that backstory, and for years, people thought Steve Austin and I hated each other. Like, there was real heat there, and everybody knew the story. I fired by FedEx and all that kind of crap, because Steve used that to help get his character over in ECW. Steve talked about it all the time. He did, you know, a parody of me wearing a wig and all that. And so Steve used the fact that I fired him to help get his character over in ECW, so that by the time he got to WWE and got through the Ringmaster gimmick, became Stone Cold Steve Austin again, I show up in WWE at some point, 2001, whatever it was, and now there's a built-in storyline between me and Steve Austin. The backstory had already been written. The backstory was like, everybody knew about it. You know, wrestling fans were really aware of it, because again, Steve used it to help get his character over. So now I'm in charge of, as a character, in charge of Monday Night Raw. Vince McMahon comes up to me and says, you know, "Okay, here's what you got to do. You know, you want to keep your job, you got to go sign Steve Austin." And because we had so much backstory that we didn't have to regurgitate, it was all right there in the top of everybody's minds. It made that storyline so effective because it was real. The lines between what was creative and scripted and what was real had been being blurred for so long that it just made that story so easy for the audience to grab a hold of. And it worked. And ultimately, I got to work a lot with Steve, you know, promos in the ring, co-GM stuff. But the cherry on top of it all was walking out at No Way Out in Montreal, wrestling Stone Cold Steve Austin. Now, in fairness, it wasn't really a wrestling match. It was more of an ass kicking, but that's what the people wanted. You know, I'm not a wrestler. I never was. I knew what the gimmick was going in. And Steve was still feeling the effects of the injury. So Steve was in no position to take a bad bump from an unskilled wannabe professional wrestler. So I knew what my role was, but going out into that crowd, coming down the ramp in Montreal, sold out crowd, one of the best crowds you're going to find anywhere is Montreal, just rabid. Toronto, same way. walking out there because I had so much heat at the time, knowing that when that match finishes, that place is going to explode. And that was the anticipation of me. That's what I was excited about. And it so over-delivered. It was, no question about it, the most fun I've ever had in the ring. You know, it's not the best segment I've ever done or segments. You know, that goes to did I just hear 3 minutes, whatever, or say 3 minutes. That was cool. But wrestling Steve Austin in Montreal was one of, if not the highlights of my career. And none of it would have happened if I wouldn't have fired him. So it's one of the best decisions I've ever made for Steve and for me.
All right, Eric, our number one.
Does anybody know who this is? Y'all are listening. I know we're not taking questions and comments. I really wish we were.
Drop it in the comments. Drop it in the comments. Let's see if you got number one right. Number one is the Honky Tonk Man.
The Honky Tonk Man has left the building, baby. And I was so happy to see it. That's the one exception. That's the one exception. I actually enjoyed firing him. And only because he deserved it. He was such an ass and had such an incredibly unrealistic and high opinion of himself at the time. And then, you know, that old school, I'm going to work the young boss. I'm going to take my shot. And he gave me an ultimatum. And that's another thing that I don't respond well. I don't respond well at all to ultimatums. I never have. I just, if anything is going to push a hot button, it's giving me an ultimatum. So since I didn't have a lot of respect for not that I didn't respect the work that he did in WWF, because he did. He had a great career there. And there was a time and a place for a character like the Honky Tonk Man. Unfortunately, time moves on and Honky Tonk Man still felt like that gimmick was viable and I knew better. And when he decided to call me out and see if he could give me an ultimatum and have me succumb and give him what he wanted, which was a contract, because he was on a per night deal. And when he refused to go along with what I wanted him to do, which was to, I believe it was to drop the TV title to Johnny B. Badd, it was like, no, I'm not doing that. Cool. I really didn't want to hire him anyway. I was kind of pressured into it in a way by Jimmy Hart. And ultimately Jimmy, you know, tagged in Hulk to put in a good word for Brutus, but for Honky Tonk Man. And Hulk did, not with a lot of enthusiasm or pressure, but you know, he did because Jimmy asked him to. So I brought Honky Tonk in kind of reluctantly, paid him like $1,000 a night or something. And when he gave me that ultimatum, it was like, oh man, if there's ever a time to feel good about making a decision like this, it's right here and now. Thank you, baby. Thank you very much, Honky Tonk Man. I appreciate everything you brought to the table. You don't mean a shit to me anymore, but hey, you go be you. You know, that was fun. I enjoyed it. And it's one that I'm proud of.
Did, after you released the Honky Tonk Man, did Jimmy ever come up to you and say, hey, baby, I'm sorry about it.
No, I think Jimmy was disappointed because I think Jimmy believed that there was money in Honky Tonk Man. And I understand why. You know, he had a lot of success with Honky Tonk and Jimmy, like a lot of us, a lot of top talent then and to this day, go back to things that worked in the past and formulas that worked in the past. I think Jimmy really believed that there was money in Honky Tonk. It's just that at that point, we were evolving away from the kind of cartoonish, silly characters and into more of reality-based characters. Not that they all were. I wasn't going in that direction with everybody. There were still some very animated characters that were part of the roster, as there should have been, as should be to this day. You know, Ivar in WWE is a perfect example of what I'm talking about. It's a very cartoonish animated character, the Ivar character. Now, he has since come out with something new recently, a little bit more of a reality-based character. But, you know, there's always a place and time for certain types of characters. You don't want them all to be the same. But I think Jimmy believed that there was money in it. It's just that we were evolving away from it, and Honky Tonk Man wasn't one of those animated characters that I was interested in keeping. I just didn't see the value in them. And I think I was 100% correct. Maybe the next time we do this, we'll talk about the top five people I should have fired but didn't. Yeah, that is a great idea. That's going to be our next top five. The five people I wish I would have fired but didn't.
That's a great teaser right there.
Man. All right, let's do that. Thank you, Super Dave. Thanks, everybody, for joining.